You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a travel expert shares some advice to help people get into camping this summer here in Wisconsin. First, the world of comics has expanded far beyond the typical superhero narratives or the pages of the Sunday paper. You can find comics about just about everything: mental health, marriage, war, travel, memoir. One small publishing company with Madison connections adds more to the genre, publishing what they call queer comics for queer folks. Kat Parra and Zora Gilbert are the founders of Margins Publishing, a small press publishing company focused on creating and distributing comics about and by marginalized creators. They met while attending the same high school in Madison. Kat, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Zora, thanks for being with us.
Hey there.
Kat, can you talk about the origin stories behind Margins Publishing?
Sure. So, like you mentioned, me and Zora met in high school, and then we just kind of went off to separate colleges for a little bit, but we still kind of kept connected and both have this really strong connection to comics, and, you know, had a lot of thoughts and feelings about queer representation in media, and kind of what we wanted to do with comics. And ultimately, we decided to put together this project called Dates, an Anthology of Queer Historical Fiction, and Margins is kind of what we put Dates under as a name. Essentially, Margins was because of the desire to do Dates as a project.
And Zora, when you looked at the world of comics and graphic novels before, did you see not enough representation of groups, or bad representation, or a little of both?
I think there was a little of both, especially in the mainstream. One of the things that we were actually really inspired by was good representation on the margins. So there are a couple indie comic creators. Well, there's lots of indie comic creators, but a couple of them had gotten on Kickstarter and had success with, you know, crowdfunded small press anthologies. And that was really inspiring to us. And we got really excited and just dove in.
And Kat, it might sound fun. I'm going to make a comic book. A lot of work goes into that. Could you take us through some of the kind of just the nuts and bolts of what goes into making a project like this?
Well, the biggest thing for a big group project like an anthology is definitely like bringing everybody together and kind of, you know, herding cats, essentially, right? So we've had, you know, like 30 plus creators on the different, on each of the different volumes. So that's a lot of like people to manage and like timelines to manage, because every single one of those comics, you know, you need to make the script, you need to do thumbnails, you need to pencil, ink, toning, lettering to finally have that completed project, you know. And then once those are put together, even there's all of the, you know, wrapping it up into a book that is mostly something that Zora actually takes care of. They've become pretty amazing at doing all the pre-press stuff. So yeah, it's loads and loads of work for sure.
And Zora, can you tell us about the anthologies that Kat just mentioned? What we read, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course. So Dates is an anthology of queer historical fiction. They're collections of short comics, up to 15 pages, by lots and lots of different creators, many of whom are fairly new to the industry. They've just started out. We've had some people in college who are just incredibly talented. The stories in Dates specifically all take place before 1965. They're all about queer characters, and there are no tragic endings, which was one of our mission statements going in, is we wanted these to be happy stories.
Yeah, Kat, talk about that, the importance of wanting happy endings in these.
Sure. So one of the things that we notice in like a lot of media, but particularly in stuff that's like in historical settings, is that if they do remember that queer characters exist, they kind of tend to shove them into these negative narratives of like, well, of course they're going to die tragically because, you know, queer people were never happy in the past because they're barely happy now, you know, and that's not true. Like, there's definitely examples that you can find in the past of queer people living, you know, successful and happy lives, even if maybe some stuff was, like, secret or, you know, you kind of have to keep stuff low-key, but, like, they found ways, they were successful, they were happy, and we wanted kind of a way to showcase that and to give people a chance to be creative and see themselves having, you know, or people like them kind of having thrived always as like a way of, you know, hope for the future, I guess.
I just wanted to mention that there's also a lot of Eurocentricity in our historical fiction that we have access to, and that Eurocentricity tends to cast queer identities in a really like fraught light, whereas lots of other cultures have really rich histories of what we would consider queer identities in like incredibly normal situations. Like those are just part of being alive rather than on the margins.
We're talking to Zora Gilbert and Kat Parra, founders of Margins Publishing, with strong Wisconsin ties, talking about their work and issues of representation. And Kat, why is it important for marginalized people to be represented, you know, both in the comics themselves and among the creators?
I mean, if anything, it's definitely more important to be represented among the creators because there's been such little opportunity for people to tell their own stories and tell the stories that they're passionate about. And I think it's just, you know, we want our society to be reflected in the media that it creates, you know, and this is a great big, you know, colorful world full of, you know, lots of people of color, lots of queer people, and those people need an opportunity to make their voices heard. And they really have been really stifled, I think, in comics specifically, which has been very white, very male, and, you know, very straight and cis. And so everyone deserves those opportunities.
And Zora, as the two of you go out and look for contributors, is it, there's this groundswell of people who want to be on board, or are you going to having to go out and really seek them out?
So we've been lucky, and every time we've opened submissions, we've been overwhelmed by people. I think there's a real hunger to tell these stories and to be able to tell one's own story. Our editorial philosophy is really focused on the story that the creator wants to tell. And I think that that's really appealing to people.
And Kat, can you talk a little bit about your love of the comic medium in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that something that's so fantastic about comics is that no two people are ever going to make the same comic. Everyone has their own artistic sensibilities that they bring to the visuals. Everyone has their own ideas that they bring to the writing. I mean, even if you had the same script, you would get a completely different comic from two different artists. And I think that's so unique, the way that more than anything, I think comics, you can really put your soul on the page. And just that combination of written and visual, I think is totally unique. You know, there's nothing like it. I mean, I'd love it to death.
And Zora, same question. If you have things you'd like to add to what Kat had to say.
I mean, Kat hit most of the points. I think that comics are really unique in how they meld the written and the visual, but also you get this because it's paneling rather than film. You get to really savor moments, and you can make specific panels and specific beats have such an impact. And that's very exciting.
And Kat, what kind of projects are in the works now for Margins?
We don't actually have a whole lot in the pipeline right now. I mean, we had kind of planned to sort of take a little bit of time away from doing Margins after we finished our big push for Dates Volume 3. and then everything that happened with, you know, the pandemic and everything, it hasn't been a great time to get stuff underway. So we don't currently have anything in the works, but I expect that within the next year, we may have another little project. We're kind of planning to do stuff a little bit smaller, a little bit quirkier, maybe. So, yeah, keep an eye out for that.
And Zora, as we wrap up, for people out there who might be, you know, a member of a marginalized group, can you talk about the idea of doing what the two of you have done and kind of taking the production into your own hands?
It's great. It's really hard. I encourage people to, if they have a story they want to tell or they have a project that they want to do and like get people together to do it and to find a way to do it. We're always happy to talk to people and talk about our experiences and how to maybe apply those experiences to somebody else's idea. You can hit us up on Twitter at Margins Comics. But yeah, I absolutely seize it. Even if it's a small thing, doing it is the best way to learn how to do it. And the more people we have doing it, the better.
Zora, thanks a lot for joining us today. Oh, I'm sorry, Kat, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, just can I add, I think it's maybe never been a better time to try and do independent projects with Kickstarter and social media and the ability to reach your base. So yeah, absolutely go for it.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Kat Parra and Zora Gilbert, founders of Margins Publishing, a small press publishing company focused on creating and distributing comics about and by marginalized creators. You can check out their published titles at margins.press. Coming up, the DNR and a group of volunteers have been on a hunt for rare plants around Wisconsin. We'll find out what they've discovered, including an unusual carnivorous plant. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a carnivorous English sundew was just one of the rare plants volunteers spotted in Wisconsin last year. We'll talk with the leader of the program that goes out in search of rare specimens about the newest report. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about food and memory.
Araceli Esparza's grandmother picked vegetables for canning factories in Wisconsin. Among the vegetables she picked were beets, which stained her hands with both their color and smell. Araceli tells us how the smell of beets unleashed memories of her grandmother's hands.
Honoring las manos de abuelita y el movimiento de César Chávez y los trabajadores. Betabel. Betabel rojo, sabor de tierra húmeda, la cual nunca he probado antes de hoy.
Honoring the hands of my grandmother and the movement of César Chávez and the workers. Red beet, the taste of a wet earth, the one I've never tasted until today. The curious thing is that I already knew your taste through the hands of my grandmother who long ago picked you. She pulled you from our mother earth. She picked you in the camps of Nebraska and the fields of Wisconsin, and your color stained her hands. Your smell permeated her skin, and I remembered her in the taste and smell of a beet. I know because today I smelled you beet, and with the taste in my mouth of the humid and wet mornings, once again I was there, hugged by her, mi abuelita. I wrote this because I wanted to honor the work that my grandmother has done. You know, growing up, she told me about the unions, about caring for my neighbors, about caring for those who didn't have, and to cherish what we did have. I know she was also part of the César Chávez movement of, like, very much against the pesticides that were used. And I guess I wrote this poem after eating beets that were given in a class that I was substituting for. The beets were from a community garden program that gives their harvest to schools with a high percentage of children on free reduced lunch programs. None of them had tasted beets, the children, that day. And I thought I hadn't either. And the moment the bag was opened and we passed out the snacks, the entire room filled with her, mi abuelita's smell. Just that earthy morning, that fresh, like it rained last night and you can just feel things growing, right? I held back the tears while eating one, and I watched the kids inspect them, eat them, admire their color, and I knew then that it wasn't my first time eating one. I just never knew I had. Te jaló de la tierra madre, te piscó en los campos de Nebraska, en los fieldes de Wisconsin. My grandmother is 92 years old, and I'm sure her longevity has a lot to do with beets.
Tu color manchó sus manos, tu olor se impregnó en su piel. Recordé a abuelita con el sabor y olor del betabel. Lo sé porque hoy te olí, betabel, y con el sabor en mi boca de la tierra de las mañanas húmedas, y otra vez estuve allí abrazada de mi abuelita, ella.
Araceli Esparza is a poet, writer, and teacher in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, English sundew, prairie turnip, silver bladder pod. They're not household names here in Wisconsin, but they're a big deal when you find them. They are rare Wisconsin plants, and tracking their presence here in the state is done in part by volunteers working with the state's Department of Natural Resources. The DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program recently released its 2019 report that included discovering 59 populations of rare plants in new locations. English sundew, actually an insect-eating plant, was spotted in Ashland County by volunteers for the first time in 40 years, and it's got the Central Time staff really curious. Kevin Doyle coordinates the Rare Plant Monitoring Program for the DNR, where he's a natural heritage conservation botanist. Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us what it means to be a rare plant here in Wisconsin that you and the volunteers are seeking.
We've got about 322 rare plants, to be exact. So these are species that are listed as endangered, threatened, or special concern. And they can be rare for a number of reasons. So some are rare because they're found at the edge of their range here in Wisconsin. So they're species that maybe are found more commonly in Canada or more found more commonly found in the southern United States, and they just barely sneak into the state. Others are limited to a really unique habitat. Maybe that's a cool, moist cliff or a calcareous fen, like a springy wetland, these things that we just don't have a lot of, and they have these really unique requirements. And then, of course, there's other ones that were probably much more widely distributed across the state, but their habitat has been completely decimated. So things that prairie plants that are found on really rich soil have primarily been converted to agricultural land. Other wetlands have been drained, swamps have been logged, et cetera, et cetera. So plants can be rare for a number of reasons. So of the 322 that we are interested in Wisconsin, it kind of encapsulates a lot of that diversity.
And tell us how the Rare Plant Monitoring Program works. How do you at the DNR and this group of volunteers go and seek these guys out?
So every spring we have training sessions around the state, and that's where we meet with people who are interested in the program, talk about why we care about rare plants, what the data is used for. Then there's like field skills, how to use a GPS, how to read a map, and then the kind of survey protocols, how to collect data and what data to collect. And then we send people out to these known populations. So our program within the DNR maintains a database of all the rare plants and animals that have ever been observed across the state. So if we're just looking at plants, there's over 5,000 of these populations of these 322 species that have ever been observed across the state. And so, of course, 5,000 populations is way more than just me as the DNR botanist can visit with any regularity. So we realized we needed to collaborate with volunteers, other people out there that are going just on their own time or hiking around and visiting these areas. And so we kind of equipped them with maps and any other data that will help them on their survey. Then they go out, visit the site, see if they can find the plants. If they can, collect some data and then submit it to us.
Let's zoom in on one of these plants that caught our eye here, the Ashland County Rare Carnivore, the English sundew. Tell us about it and its rediscovery in the county.
So English sundew is a state-threatened plant. There's only about 5 populations have ever been observed in Wisconsin, all around Lake Superior, these coastal wetlands around Lake Superior, where you might see pitcher plants, which is another carnivorous plant, a lot of moss, a lot of cranberries and things like that, spruce, these kind of boggy wetlands. So only 5 populations have ever been found in the state. And of those, only 2 have been seen in the last 40 years. So there's three of the 5 populations haven't been seen in like 100 years. And those populations, we have very poor locational information on those. They might say collected in 1897 from the Lake Superior area. So we really, aren't going to be able to find that one. But so 2 of these populations were seen relatively recently in the last 40 years. But that's still a long time and more than enough time for that habitat to change dramatically and for these populations to disappear. So last year, we had a volunteer named Don Evans. Him and his wife were kayaking around Lake Superior, and they were kind of kayaking, paddling around this wetland, and they noticed on this log there were some interesting plants, and so they snapped some pictures, and they they emailed me the pictures and said, "Hey, Kevin, you know, we were out and about. We found this plant. Thought it was kind of interesting. It looks like a sundew. What do you think?" And when I saw it, so we have four sundew species in the state. Two are rare and two are relatively common. And when I saw it, I knew it was one of the rare ones. But from the pictures, I couldn't tell exactly which one it was. And so a colleague of mine, suggested that we contact a person we know up at Northern College, Sarah Johnson, because she does a lot of work in the area and she's a good botanist. And so we said, "Hey, Sarah, if you have time, could you check out this site? You know, we think there's we're pretty confident it's a rare sundew, but maybe you could go out there and confirm it for us." And sure enough, she went out with some students. They found the location and confirmed the idea of this English sundew. So it was a pretty amazing find. Again, this is the first time the species, this population in particular, has been seen in 40 years. So we really had no idea if it was around or not. And so it was great news. And it was an example of, you know, Don and his wife, if they weren't involved in this program, they would have made this observation and just kind of kept the pictures to themselves and thought, like, you know, it's kind of an interesting plant. But the fact that they were tied in to the Rare Plant Monitoring Program, they had a place to send their data. So it really worked out pretty well.
There's a great picture of the English sundew on the DNR News site. In our last 30 seconds or so, Kevin, if people wanted to get involved, I know the training's probably already been done for 2020, but if they want to get involved in the future, are you looking for more volunteers?
Yeah, every year, like I said before, we have four training sessions around the state. So the best way to get involved is you have to participate in those trainings, but the best way to stay up to date on when the trainings happen is to sign up for the Natural Heritage Conservation Newsletter. And you'll get announcements about the program, but when the trainings are announced, which is usually January or February, you'll get an email about it and you can sign up at that time.
Kevin, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
Kevin Doyle is a DNR Natural Heritage Conservation Botanist. He talked to us today about some discoveries from the 2019 Rare Plant Monitoring Program report, including finding the insect-eating English sundew in Ashland County for the first time in 40 years. Coming up, more people are getting out to camp this summer as travel plans get canceled during the COVID-19 pandemic. A travel expert tells us how to plan your best camping trip in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the president's latest attacks on voting by mail, his call for a delay to the election, and what it could all mean in November. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, camping has always been a popular summertime activity for friends, family, or even solo adventurers. This may be especially true this year, as the COVID-19 pandemic has forced people to cancel travel plans and consider activities closer to home. For people who are new to camping, it may seem a little daunting as you look at the gear or figure out how to start a fire on your own. Our next guest joins us to help plan for your best camping trip, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone or are you going camping for the first time ever or in a long time this summer because of changes to your travel plans? Do you need advice for how to camp and where to camp around Wisconsin, or do you have some advice to give if you're an experienced camper, maybe for the first timer? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kevin Revelinsky is with us, freelance travel writer. He blogs at themadtraveler.com. Kevin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, give us a little 101 for that person out there thinking, okay, my interstate trip is off the table now. Maybe I'm going to try this camping thing. How do they get started?
Well, I have to adapt it to the current situation with the virus, because normally you would be able to just go out there and sometimes on a weekend and show up at a state park and take the first come, first serve campsites. But this year, because of the situation with the pandemic, you have to reserve ahead of time for all state parks, for all campsites, and you have to get your annual car sticker to go in. Online or by phone from the DNR before you go. You can't show up at state parks and just get the sticker because there's no one to do that. So that's a little odd bit of prior planning that we need to take into consideration. all that up front, then you have to decide what kind of camping you want to do. What's your level of comfort? So there's everything from these modern campgrounds at a lot of the state parks where you've got showers, you've got electricity at your site. Some of them even have Wi-Fi. Or you can go all the way to the other end and backpack into a national park and set up a dispersed camping. So not even a designated campground. So everyone has, I think, their level of comfort, and that's the first thing to consider when you're planning your destination.
And talk a little more about car camping. That sounds like an easy first, dip your toes in the camping water way to approach it. What do people need to get together after premeditating that trip and reserving spots where they need to?
Well, you have to be prepared, obviously, for how you're going. You know, where you're going to sleep. Are you bringing a pop-up camper? Are you bringing tents? Then you have to consider your sleeping bag. A lot of people like to have a mat to sleep on top of. I mean, when I was younger, we used to just sleep over the tree roots and the rocks, and it was no big deal. Now I'm a little older, and I get up in the morning, and I'm kind of grouchy if I didn't get that sleeping pad in there. And then plan your meals. With car camping, it's so much easier because you can put whatever you want in that car. You can have your cooler in there with a lot of ice, so you're not, you know, carrying your gear far into the woods. So it's a bit more comfortable, I think, for people getting started, and even for, you know, people who've done it for many years. You have to have things for emergencies, you know, bug bites, your sunscreen or aloe vera for when you didn't bring the sunscreen, things like that to consider. Plan your meals out. You don't want to be heading into town all the time to get your supplies. And it's so easy to pick sites now online. When you go in, the websites are fantastic for county parks, for city parks, for state parks. You can literally go in and see photos of the campsite you're selecting. So I think that makes it more approachable for just about everybody.
We were talking about camping in Wisconsin this summer as maybe travel plans have changed, getting advice for new campers. Kevin Revelinsky is with us, freelance travel writer. He blogs at themadtraveler.com. His books include Best Tent Camping Wisconsin, among many others. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your camping questions or your camping advice. Tim joins us now in Janesville. Tim, hi.
How are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Tim?
Well, a couple things. I had a recent trip to northern Wisconsin. Well, actually, I went to Upper Michigan. And then I dropped into Peninsula Park in Door County to pick up some cherries. And I was presently surprised that I could get a place in Peninsula Park. I reserved it through that new Wisconsin site, which is great. I was so glad that they got rid of that horror site, Reserve America, here. So things are easy, and I actually did it on the phone because I'm not savvy with computers. And I have a question. What happened to the tower up in Peninsula Park? They've taken it down and they're rebuilding something?
That's a long-running saga, Tim. We could take the whole half hour on that, I think. Tim, thanks for the call. Kevin, did you want to touch on that and then talk about it sounds like Tim had a pretty good experience booking that
campsite. Yeah, they have changed providers, and I think that's great. It seems to be a really good system and easy to use. Reserve America is still, or is it recreation.gov? Sorry. Yeah, it's for the national parks. But yeah, that's it's so convenient now. You don't have to gamble about the first come, first serve, especially during a busy time like summer. In terms of that tower, yes, they are replacing it.
Well, that's the good short version. Thank you. And thanks for the call, Tim, at 800-642-1234. Okay, Kevin, I know, let's talk tents a little bit. I know there's a zillion kinds in the market. It could be easy to start shopping around and have like mental paralysis, overwhelmed with the choices. What questions should people be asking themselves as they try to pick a tent?
How many people do you want to fit in that tent? And the answer should be probably the number that the tent says it holds divided by two. Because when it says three people, you're lucky if you get, you know, an adult and a child in there. I don't know who they're aiming these tents at. But something, it should always be waterproof, and I would say that most of them are going to be anyways, but then looking at the seams to make sure that they're done in a way that when it rains, it doesn't just go around your waterproofing. It's great to go to a qualified sports store and get good advice, too, I think. Then they can answer very specific questions that you might have. But I like something that can be airy when the weather's very hot. I like to have screens up top so I can take that canopy off and see the stars through them, or put it back on when it's raining. And you should also bring a something to lay out under the tent to help keep from moisture from coming up underneath, you know, like a tarp of some sort.
We're talking to Kevin Revelinsky right now about camping for beginners here in Wisconsin. He's a freelance travel writer, blogs at themadtraveler.com. His books include Best Tent Camping Wisconsin, among others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question? Do you need some advice about camping? How, where, why? Do you have some advice for others that you'd like to share? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about camping in Wisconsin with Kevin Revelinsky, freelance travel writer, blogger at themadtraveler.com, and author of books including Best Tent Camping Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your questions or your advice, maybe answers to questions, hard won in your camping experience. Back to your calls now. Victor is with us in West Allis. Victor, hi.
Hi. Hey, a couple of things. One, when people first get familiar with a Coleman stove with the white lightning fuel, we come across a lot of times where people have flare-ups, and the best way to solve that in a cold morning is take a couple little drops, put it on your burner, light it, let it warm up, and then proceed and lighten your stove. Otherwise, you get a real bad flare-up. Number two, a lot of people with the pots and pans, the bottom gets really black. The best way to solve that problem is put a little dish detergent, like Dawn on the bottom, rub it on the bottom, and when you use your Coleman stove, you won't have all that black gook on it.
Interesting, Victor. Some cooking advice for the campers pre-warming that Coleman stove. Kevin, do you have thoughts, a cooking tip or two to share with the camping cooks?
You know, I love cooking over a campfire over the coals. And one thing we like to do is we prepackage meals like in tinfoil, wrap them up with, you know, maybe it's a piece of, you know, chopped meat and vegetables so that when you get there, you just put them on the coals and you don't even need a pan to cook in that method. And some of the meals can be quite fancy, especially if you're car camping and you've got, you know, a good cooler and it's, you can keep your food cold. I've had friends who have brought out octopus to the campsite.
Wow.
We grilled octopus on the Wisconsin River, actually, which is not what you would expect as campfire food, but pretty
much
not
just fresh caught out of the Wisconsin River, I'm going to guess.
No.
that'd be a story. Let's go back to our callers now. Dave is with us in Janesville. Dave, hi.
Hello. Yeah, I'd like to add is what I use underneath my tent is a piece of indoor-outdoor carpet for helping keep, you know, the moisture and sticks and twigs, and then you have it sitting outside the tent so you can step on it and get the sand and dirt off your shoes, and you can take your shoes off out there on that so you don't get the mess in your tent.
That's
interesting.
A good tip. And that is, I think, an important thing to be able to leave your shoes out there where they're not going to get wet, but where they're not coming in with all the sand and dirt. Yeah.
Dave, great suggestion. Thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Charles next in Eau Claire. Charles, hi.
Hey, Charles.
Hi. My wife and I are planning on doing a two-week camping trip around Wisconsin, and I was wondering if you have any recommendations for, like, free campsites or some spectacular state parks that we could take a look at in, you know, every region of Wisconsin, but, you know, considering the times that we're in.
Yeah, right. well, let's see. Have you been to Big Bay State Park out on Madeline Island?
No, we've been to Ashland.
Yeah, the Prentice Park, maybe, in the city. But out on Madeline Island, Big Bay is great. It's got nice dark skies, but of course you have to take a ferry to get over to the island. There's also a lot of great, you were talking about free campsites. I don't have any that come to mind, but there's very cheap ones in the northern, the National Forest. Over on the Nicolet side, I can think of some along Highway 70 there where it's maybe six sites in a ring, like Chipmunk Rapids, right along the Pine River there. That's one of my favorites. And those are places that generally you can show up and there's nobody there. I've been to places like that on 4th of July and driven in, and maybe there's one other camper. So those are nice, remote, but not too far off the beaten trail either.
Fantastic. Have a great trip, Charles. Are there other parts of the state, Kevin, where you think it's easy to, you know, put together a nice itinerary, not too much driving from one site to another, spend a couple few days over the course of, like Charles is doing, over the course of a couple weeks?
Well, northern Wisconsin's the best for that, especially now when the parks are getting busier in the southern half of the state. Marinette County is popular for all its waterfalls. And they've got a lot of good county parks that you could stay at there and, you know, take the day and go around to the different waterfalls. And then I think move west through the National Forest into places like Northern Highland, American Legion State Forest, which is closer to Minocqua, in that area. And they've got four modern campsites and or campgrounds and lots of trails and a lot of things to do in that area as well.
Let's bring on another call. Go ahead. Let's bring on another caller. Kent is with us in Reedstown. Kent, hi.
Yeah, hi. When I camp, I dehydrate my meals, so I just make an extra at home and then dehydrate it. And then when I'm camping, I just use these little – I got a little wood stove that I bought online that is very small. You just put little kindling in it, and it heats up faster than the stove at home. So I put the dehydrated meal, I put it – soak it in water the morning before I want to eat it. And then when I get to the campsite at night, I just heat it up in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes on the little wood stove, and I got my meal.
And what sort of things are you dehydrating?
Well, you can dehydrate almost anything. I don't eat meat, but meat's a little more problematic. But
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you just look online about dehydrating, and there's a packing backpacking dehydrating site that goes into all the details. So you can dry anything, and it works great, very quick.
Kent, thanks a lot for the call. Great idea.
A lot of those pre-made meals for camping are dehydrated things, but I've never heard of somebody making their own, so that's kind of neat.
I love it. Well, in our last minute or so, Kevin, I know you love to travel in Wisconsin and around the world. Do you have any trips coming up that you're really looking forward to?
Yeah, I'm going way, way out of Wisconsin to the UP.
Oh, all the way.
I'm going to the Porcupine Mountains, actually.
Nice.
I'm planning to do some camping up there in about October. But, yeah, the long-distance trips are, well, they might be a long distance off.
Off the table for now. Well, leave us 20, 30 seconds or so with a pep talk for people on the fence about trying this whole camping concept.
Oh, you know, I think there's nothing better for your peace of mind than to get out into the wild, get into the green space and the blue space, and just clear your head, especially during these times when there's just a lot of stuff going on. You unplug and then just plug back into nature when you get there.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thanks for having me on.
Kevin Revelinsky is a freelance travel writer. He blogs at themadtraveler.com. His books include Best Tent Camping Wisconsin. He's written a lot about Wisconsin outdoors and travel along the way. We've been getting a little crash course, Camping 101. You can keep sharing your advice, by the way. If you have a tip you'd like to share about camping, maybe for that first timer out there, you can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know what was a discovery you made that really improved your camping experience. Again, let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coronavirus has put a spotlight on doctors. Many risked their own health to care for COVID-19 patients. Some lost their lives. It's a grim reality of the job, but it hasn't stopped people from applying to medical school. What the pandemic has done is make an already difficult career to pursue, in many ways, even harder. Shemaine Mills explains.
Long before they use a stethoscope or wear a white coat, prospective doctors have to get into medical school. The application process is long and complicated. Acceptance rates are generally low. Some students who want to be physicians are having second thoughts, not about the career itself, but the timing. The country remains in the grip of a pandemic, which earlier this year temporarily brought life to a near standstill. The deadly virus disrupted classes, volunteer work, and other key activities that could make a pre-med student stand out in a sea of applicants. That's what Dr. Joseph Kirchner heard when hosting an online forum for a couple thousand pre-med students across the country. Kirchner is dean of the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Heard concern in their voice, you know, heard a lot of worries, heard them express difficulties at this time with the pandemic.
So Kirchner followed up that virtual town hall with a written column directed at pre-med students.
I felt called to write back to tell them, look, we heard you, we understand that this has been hard, but here's all the reasons why you should persevere, here's all the reasons why this is a great step for you to pursue.
Kirchner acknowledged the COVID-19 pandemic is presenting pre-med students with challenges unlike any in medical history. Despite the hurdles, he says the medical college is seeing applications hold steady or possibly increasing. 21-year-old Juan Adrian Lozama knows these hurdles all too well. He intended to take the medical college admission test this spring, but that was at the height of the pandemic. And officials didn't want hundreds of students packed into the same room spreading germs. So testing was temporarily called off, throwing the plans of Lozama and thousands of others across the country out the window.
End of April. That's what I wanted to shoot for. Not only was it full, but the beginning dates for April were canceled. So, of course, anything that followed that was just all full. The earliest one I could take is in June.
2 days before taking the all-important test, Lozama's grandfather died from COVID-19. The Milwaukee native was devastated but determined. He tearfully recalled how his grandfather had encouraged his dream of someday becoming a doctor.
I need to do this for him because he believed in me and trying to pursue this career.
One of the reasons Lozama wants to work in medicine is to provide better care for patients of color. The current COVID-19 crisis has affected blacks and Latinos the most, and his grandfather's death brought those sad statistics home. Lozama expected to be excited or nervous for the big test needed to get into medical school, but the family tragedy made it difficult to concentrate on what he'd studied and planned for since high school.
The exam felt indifferent. It just felt all monotonous. It didn't have feeling at all. And so I was like, oh, I don't think I did that well.
Turns out he underestimated himself. Lozama says he scored in the 75th percentile. He's applied to 3 medical schools, including the Medical College of Wisconsin. Lozama's gotten a taste of what it might be like to work in medicine by volunteering at a free health clinic in Milwaukee and how he might be uniquely qualified to help.
Sometimes we get patients that can't communicate that well in English, right? So there was one that his native language was Spanish, right? And I was able to help in that because I was working there at that time. When I was able to at least translate what they were saying to him, it seemed that he felt more at ease.
Making that kind of difference for patients is part of why Lozama won't let the obstacles of the pandemic get in the way of pursuing his dream. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. In the early days of the pandemic, the White House announced a nationwide testing program. That never came into action. A new investigative report tells us what happened. The reporter joins the show to give us the details. The digital economy has given us tons of access to creative work online, but the author of a new book says it's come at a big cost to the creators. We'll meet the writer of the new book, The Death of the Artist, and find out what could be next for musicians, artists, and others. And we'll answer a Why Wisconsin question about the impact of the Latinx vote here in Wisconsin and around the country. That and more all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, explore the cutting edge of artificial intelligence. Kate talks to a Wisconsin expert about the latest research and what it could mean for our daily lives in the future. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then Wisconsin Public Radio Director Mike Crane drops by to talk about programming changes, a new Ideas Network station in the state, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.